Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, Senior Veterinary Nurse at Anderson Moores Veterinary Specialists, Denise Prisk. Thank you, Denise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this webinar on ventilators. I'm going to cover the basics of ventilation and look at some particular makes of ventilators that I think are commonly used in first opinion and referral practice. And I appreciate that some of you may be used to using your ventilators and maybe others have never used a ventilator before. So I'm going to try and incorporate some information to suit everyone. So we'll start off with a recap on the fundamentals of respiratory physiology. Ventilation provides the alveoli with fresh gas, allowing gas exchange to occur. Now, when you're performing manual IPPV, there's no control over the amount of pressure that we use, so lung damage because of barotrauma and volutrauma are likely. And this is especially significant in very small patients, neonates and paediatrics, geriatric patients who've got stiff lungs, or anyone really with lung disease. And this is one reason why mechanical ventilation is preferred. So the goal of mechanical ventilation is really to maintain normal capnia, normal end tidal CO2 levels. We want adequate gas exchange and minimal, or ideally no, lung injury. And a recap on terminology, which you'll all be familiar with. Tidal volume is the amount of air which goes into and out of the lungs at each respiration. So we have an inspiratory tidal volume and an expiratory tidal volume. And the minute volume is how much air goes in and out of the lungs in 1 minute. So we can calculate this easily by multiplying the tidal volume by the resting respiratory rate. In mechanical ventilation, we aim to deliver a suitable minute volume to the patient. Functional residual capacity is how much air is left in the lungs after a normal expiration, and this allows gas exchange to occur between breaths. The amount of air that's left in the lungs after the deepest possible expiration is the residual volume. And this air is always in the lungs in a patient that's alive, and it's there to maintain a negative pressure. Some terms which are specifically related to the amount of carbon dioxide that's produced. Hypocapnia, which is usually seen as less than 35 millimetres of mercury in small animal patients, that means there's a decreased amount of CO2 in the blood. Now, the end tidal CO2, which is breathed out, is very similar to the amount of CO2 which is in arterial blood, and this is denoted with PaCO2. Hypocapnia occurs because of hyperventilation. So in a patient that's breathing on its own, it may be in pain, but a very common reason in mechanically ventilated patients is that we are overventilating them. And if it's not corrected, it can lead to respiratory alkalosis. The other end of the scale is hypercapnia, which is an increased amount of CO2 in the blood. In reality, that's over something like 55, maybe even 60 millimetres of mercury. And that occurs because of hypoventilation, so they're not breathing enough. And if it's uncorrected, it can lead to respiratory acidosis. Just a point to note is that hypoventilation and hypothermia often go together. So if your patient is hypoventilating and you've got a high end tidal CO2, just check its temperature, make sure it's not cold. And then normocapnia is normal levels of CO2 in the blood. And this is usually quoted to be 35 to 45 millimetres of mercury. You may see the prefix eucapnia, EU, literally means good or well. So eucapnia might be something else that you come across. Airway resistance is the resistance to the flow of air during inspiration and expiration. And it's affected by the diameter of the airway and whether there are any secretions in it. So things such as congestion or pneumonia patients who may have fluid, asthmatic cats, and it may be equipment problems. So you might have a kinked endotracheal tube or an overinflated tube cuff, and all of those will affect airway resistance. Something not to overlook is the size of the ET tube. If the ET tube is too small, then that provides quite a lot of resistance to breathing. It would be like if you were breathing through a straw for a length of time, you'd find it quite difficult. Compliance is the elasticity of the lungs or the chest wall. So we talk of pulmonary compliance and chest wall compliance. In other words, how easy is it for the lungs and the chest to expand? And compliance is affected by how elastic the lung tissue is. And in turn, that is affected by age, because as we get older, our lungs become more stiff, less elastic. It's also affected by whether there's any fluid in the lungs or the chest, and restriction from outside the body, such as cradles and troughs, which are too small. So the classic is putting a barrel-chested bulldog in dorsal recumbency in a cradle or a trough, which is really one size too small. Because of the width of their chest, then they can't expand their chest to breathe properly. It might be that maybe you're leaning on the chest, or it's got a heavy instrument placed on the chest. Tying out the forelimbs too tightly. Again, if you tie out the front legs when the animals are on their back, if you do it too tightly to get it out of the way of the chest, then it means the chest simply can't expand. And in recovery, just even placing heavy blankets on the chest of small patients. So all of these will affect compliance. In the photo here, you can see there's a dog. He's going for elbow arthroscopy. So he's on his back, and we're using sandbags here to keep him on his back, so there's no cradle or trough. And you can see that the sandbag is out of the way of the chest. PIP is the peak inspiratory pressure, so it's the pressure of gas delivered at the peak of inspiration. It's usually quoted that it shouldn't exceed 20 centimetres of water, and the reason for that is to avoid lung trauma. In the closed thorax canine patient, peak inspiratory pressure is normally around 12 to 15 centimetres of water, and it would be slightly less than that in smaller dogs or in cats. However, there are some instances when higher pressures are needed. So patients with pressure on their diaphragm, GDV patients, those that are going for splenectomy because they've got large splenic tumours, or pregnant patients with a gravid uterus, or the obese patients when we put them in dorsal recumbency. In other instances, lower pressures are needed. So if you've got long-term lung damage and the lungs have been collapsed for a long time, you can't use high or even normal pressures, because the alveoli will just rupture and leak fluid, and that's a phenomenon which is called re-expansion pulmonary edema. Also, you need lower pressures during open chest surgery, because the negative pressure of the closed thorax is lost and the lungs will just extrude out of the thoracic cavity if high pressure is used. The problem with having fixed values, so somebody saying, oh, it should never go higher than 20 centimetres of water, is that that doesn't allow for individual variations. And also it implies that pressures over 20 centimetres are dangerous. And therefore, it also implies that pressures under 20 centimetres of water are safe. And neither of that is always true. So it's a bit of an arbitrary figure. And PEEP, positive end expiratory pressure. This increases mean airway pressure and improves oxygenation. So we can use a PEEP valve. You can add a PEEP valve into the expiratory port of a breathing system. We only use really quite low pressures in small animal anaesthesia, so 2.5 or 5 centimetres of water. Some ventilators have actually got a setting for PEEP, so therefore you wouldn't need the PEEP valve. The downsides of PEEP are that it increases intrathoracic pressure, and so it decreases venous return and blood pressure. But it is useful in thoracotomy surgeries for preventing alveolar collapse and keeping the end airways partially inflated. So in the next photo, in the next slide, there's a photo of a PEEP valve. It's just two aspects of the same valve. So this is PEEP valve, which generates 2.5 centimetres of water. And the photo on the right, you can see clearly that the direction of flow is shown here. So I'll show you in the next slide how to fit the PEEP valve. We usually only use PEEP in patients that are being mechanically ventilated. So here is a setup with a PEEP valve, and what you do is just remove the expiratory tube from the soda lime canister. It's normally used on dogs and medium-sized large dogs. Rarely would we use it on cats or small dogs. So often it's a circle. So here's the inspiratory port, and this is the expiratory port. So you just take the tube out and pop your PEEP valve in. So the arrows clearly show you can't put it in upside down. The closed side goes at the top, and then you just put your expiratory tube back onto the end of the PEEP valve. You'll also notice here that there is no bag on the circle system, and that's because it is set up for the ventilator that doesn't have a bag. So this tube here connects the anaesthetic breathing system to the ventilator. There are disadvantages of artificial ventilation, whether you're doing it manually or artificially. You will get reduced venous return and cardiac output. The pressure inside the thoracic cavity is raised, and that has a negative impact on the return of blood to the heart. And that in turn will have a negative impact on cardiac output. And also, it will reduce the renal perfusion and end up with hypotension. Volutrauma or barotrauma. Volutrauma is trauma to the lungs because of volume, and barotrauma is trauma because of pressure. Both of those will result in lung damage. The terms are used synonymously. Overdistension of normal healthy alveoli will lead to stress of the wall, and the alveoli may collapse, and that condition is called atelectasis. There'll be increased fluid loss from the lungs, especially when it's combined with cold, dry gases. So in other words, when you're using a non-rebreathing system. And VQ mismatch. VQ is ventilation perfusion mismatch. V is ventilation and Q is perfusion, simply because the letter P was already taken for pressure. So VQ mismatch results from uneven ventilation. It is exactly as its name suggests. There is a mismatch between ventilation of the alveoli and perfusion. Perfusion is just supply of blood. So it may be that there is air or gas going into them, but there is no supply of blood. In mechanical ventilation, where higher airway pressures are used, the alveoli become overextended, leading to compression of the adjacent blood supply, the adjacent pulmonary capillaries. And this causes interruption to blood flow, inhibited gas exchange, and there'll be also increased alveolar dead space. So that's areas of the alveoli where gas exchange simply can't take place. And the result of all of this is ventilation perfusion mismatch. You'll notice an increased difference in the amount of CO2 in the blood and in the alveoli. So if you're able to assess blood gas analysis, then there would be quite a big difference. And the end-tidal CO2 becomes lower on capnography. And of course, there's always the human error aspect, so error in the ventilator settings, and that can lead to either respiratory acidosis or respiratory alkalosis. So why do we ventilate? Well, it may be necessary to ventilate, or you may just want to ventilate because it's easier to control the patient's breathing. So the nature of the surgery might dictate this. So when the thoracic cavity is open, as in thoracotomy, or if you're doing ruptured diaphragm repair, then the vacuum is removed from the pleural space and the lungs aren't able to expand during inspiration. Neuromuscular blocking agents aren't widely used in first opinion practice, and their use is beyond the scope of this webinar. But if you give a neuromuscular blocking agent, then all of the voluntary muscles, including the diaphragm, are paralysed and the animal cannot breathe, and you have to breathe for it. Hypoventilation, maybe due to side effects of anaesthesia, or maybe because of muscle weakness. There may be an underlying disease, so patients with Cushing's disease or some spinal disease, especially the cervical spine disease, they have weak muscles. Capnography will detect hypoventilation. If there's no capnograph, watch the chest movements. Do they correlate with the bag movements? Count the respiratory rate. If you've got a slow respiratory rate, then you'll get high end-tidal CO2, and that will be reflected in the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the blood. Obese patients, well, increased fat in the abdomen will impair ventilation, and these patients are often likely to pant under anaesthesia, so you need to take control. Ventilation can be used to detect hypercapnia or hypocapnia, or you might just want to control ventilation because their respiratory patterns are such that they are interfering with maybe the surgery or the anaesthesia. Brachycephalics, they're likely to be hypoxic anyway, and of course many brachycephalics are also obese. The ventilator generates a controlled flow of gas or air which pushes the anaesthetic gas into the patient's lungs. Now there's always a pressure gradient between the upper airway, so that's the trachea and the bronchi, and the alveoli in the lower airway, and the gas will flow along a pressure gradient. There are different types of ventilators which work in different ways with variables in their settings. One of the key things, if you're thinking of purchasing a ventilator, is it must be easy to manipulate the settings. And ventilators are classified nowadays mostly according to the way in which they operate. So volume cycled ventilators, the gas is supplied at a set volume and inspiration is ended at that volume. The patient's actual or expected tidal volume is used to set the figure. Now the set volume is delivered at a variable pressure, meaning that there is a risk of barotrauma. So this is the most common type of ventilator that we use for adult patients. Pressure cycled ventilators, the gas is supplied at a preset pressure, at which point the inspiration is ended. So the volume of gas inhaled is variable, and therefore this system is suitable for small or young patients as there is less risk of barotrauma. Time-cycled ventilators, the gas is supplied for a set duration of inspiration, but really on all modern ventilators we can set the respiratory rate, and that's a good thing because it means we can allow for an expiratory pause, which is necessary because the expiratory pause allows venous return to occur and it makes sure the lungs fully deflate and produce carbon dioxide. Modern ventilators aren't just one particular type, so you won't buy just a volume cycled ventilator, but they're normally a combination of all of these modes. You may still read of historical classification, so you might read about the mechanical thumb or the bag squeezer. So just a quick whiz through what these mean. Mechanical thumb, if you take yourself back to the days when the AST piece was a proper AST piece, it just had an inspiratory tube and then an open-ended expiratory tube. So occluding the end of the expiratory tube and then removing the occlusion allows for intermittent IPPV. Fresh gas will still continue during the occlusion and that will mean that the lungs can inflate. So this is used for patients weighing less than 10 kilograms. Minute volume dividers, these are for larger patients, and the fresh gas flow from the anaesthetic machine is set at the calculated minute volume, and then this gas is directed into a reservoir and it's then delivered to the patient. Bag squeezers are the bag in the bottle systems where the bellows are squeezed, and the intermittent blowers are the ventilators which need a driving gas, which can be either oxygen or medical air. And we're going to look in more detail at two ventilators, the Penlon and the Merlin. Other terms that you may read about, which are slightly obscure, are cycling, triggering, and mode. Technically speaking, cycling refers to how the ventilator switches from inspiration to expiration, and triggering refers to how the ventilator switches from expiration to inspiration. Normally, I think people just talk of cycling. Mode describes the pattern of breaths that are delivered. So here's a photo of a bag in the bottle ventilator. This one actually is a Blease make, but it's very similar to the Halliwell, if any of you are familiar with the Halliwell ventilator. So it's an expandable bag in an airtight bottle, and it has ascending bellows, which is very similar to hand ventilating, really. So in the left photo, it's the whole ventilator, and in the right-hand photo, it's just the bottom with the controls. So I don't know how well you can see this, but the knob here enables us to turn it from adult to pediatric mode. And then down here, we have the settings. This is tidal volume, which in this ventilator is in set in litres. So 0.3 is 300 mils. This is the respiratory rate. We can set the inspiratory-expiratory ratio. And here we can set the maximum airway pressure. And this gauge here shows us how much pressure is actually being delivered to the patient. So you can watch the needle and see how far up it goes. There are some basic rules of using a ventilator, whichever type it is. Overinflation of the lungs will result in lung trauma. Too much thoracic pressure will reduce venous return. It will reduce cardiac output. It will also reduce the blood pressure. The inspiratory-expiratory ratio should usually be at least 1 to 2 or even longer, 1 to 3 or maybe 1 to 4. If the ratio is too short, thoracic pressure doesn't drop sufficiently to allow the heart and vessels to refill with blood, meaning it will get decreased cardiac output, and it won't allow the lungs to empty fully either. So the lungs must be allowed to deflate at the end of expiration. And generally speaking, the peak inspiratory pressure shouldn't go higher than 20 centimetres of water, unless there is a reason that another figure needs to be used. Another thing is that resistance to flow should be kept as low as possible. So use large diameter endotracheal tubes, minimise the dead space, and also minimise the number of bends in the tubing. So take off the right angle bend on the T-piece, because that will provide resistance to gas as it goes round the bend. To start off mechanical ventilation, most patients don't require neuromuscular blocking agents. So if you are using these drugs, they're things like atropurium, pancuronium, vecuronium. You may be using those if you work with ophthalmic surgeons, because they require the eye to be in a central position. And the only way really to do this is to use a blocking agent. The respiratory response can be overridden with mild hyperventilation to get the CO2 levels down. So you need to increase the respiratory rate, but not the pressure. Or you can use drugs. So fentanyl, either as a bolus or a fentanyl CRI, constant rate infusion, might help, especially if the patient is bucking the ventilator. Bucking the ventilator means fighting the ventilator. Okay, so now we're going to look at the Penlon Nuffield ventilator. This is essentially, it's a human ventilator, but it is used widely in small animal practice. It's a nice ventilator because you can use it virtually on any size patient. It's small and it's portable. So compressed gas is used. That gas can be oxygen or air. The system drives a valve, which you attach to the ventilator, and that valve directs the gas flow to and from the patient. And the driving gas is independent from your fresh gas flow on your anaesthetic machine. And there are two valves that we use with this ventilator: the patient valve, which is for animals over 10 kilograms, or the Newton valve, which is for animals less than 10 kilograms. When you're using it with a patient valve, essentially it's a volume cycling ventilator. And when you're using it with a Newton valve, it becomes a pressure preset ventilator. So here we've got the valves. The Newton valve is on the left. So this one's the Newton valve for the smaller patients, and this one is the patient valve. They both have a body with various outlets on them. So I'll just talk through the outlets. The smallest one here, it's not in the view, it's hidden on the other picture. That's for attachment of the manometer tubing. So that's a little tube which attaches the valve to the ventilator and ultimately gives you the pressure. Up here is where you screw the ventilator on to the, sorry, where you screw the valve on to the base of the ventilator. Opposite the screw attachment, you've got the largest port, which is where the scavenge tube goes. The closed port is a pressure relief valve, and then that leaves you with one open port, which is where you attach the tubing, which conveys the gas either from the Newton valve or the patient valve to your breathing system. So to set it up, then you need to connect the appropriate valve, screw that into your ventilator, turn the ventilator on and make sure it's working. Then you attach your tubing, which is normally your oxygen, is your gas, to the port on the valve. And then the other end of that's a long tube. So the other end goes to the expiratory port. So it's either going to the bag port on the circle system, or a bane, or a T-piece. Or if you're using a Humphrey, it's going onto the ventilator port of the Humphrey ADE. When you're using a circle, the end of it just goes to the elbow connector on the soda lime canister. So you just take your bag off. Make sure the APL valve is closed. So for a T-piece, you can remove the bag, you can remove the whole APL valve and all of the whole T connector and attach the tube directly to the end of the T-piece circuit if you want to. Or if you didn't want to, just close the APL valve, take the bag off and attach the tube to where the bag would be. If you're using the Humphrey system, the tubing goes directly to the ventilator port, which is the big port next to the bag. The bag can be left in place on the Humphrey because the lever must then be set to the down position. And when you turn the lever down, that takes the bag and the Humphrey valve out of the circuit. So for Humphrey users, there's no need to close the Humphrey valve. And then you attach the scavenge to the exhaust port on the ventilator valve. So we'll look at that in a photo here, and I'll just talk through it again. So here is your driving gas, which is usually oxygen, but it might be medical air. This is where you screw your valve on. So here we've got a Newton valve, so this is going to a T-piece. This is the scavenge tube from your normal scavenge system. And here is your long tubing, which is going to the expiratory port of your circuit. The settings on the Penlon Nuffield, you've got an inspiratory time of 0.2 to 2 seconds and an expiratory time of 0.5 to 4 seconds and an inspiratory flow rate. This flow rate sets the pressure, the amount of pressure that's going into the chest. Now, this is in litres per second, and the lowest that you can go is 0.25, so that's 250 mils. It does go as far as 2 litres. That would be massive, and we'd never use anything like that in small animal anaesthesia. Remember, sorry, I'll take that out of the way. Remember, it is a human ventilator. So we can calculate the respiratory rate by adding the inspiratory and expiratory times together and dividing by 60. So if we had an inspiratory time of 1 second and an expiratory time of 3, that gives us a whole cycle period of 4 seconds. So 60 divided by 4 would give us a respiratory rate of 15 breaths per minute. In general, a short, sharp inflation followed by a longer expiratory pause will ensure effective lung inflation and gas exchange. For most adult animals, inspiratory time is generally maybe 1 to 1.5 seconds with an expiratory time of 2 to 3 seconds. So I don't know how well you can see this, but here we've got an inspiratory time is set on 2.0, so it's 2 seconds. The expiratory time over here is set on 4 seconds. So that is giving us a whole respiratory cycle of 6 seconds. So 60 divided by 6 is 10. So for this patient, we have a respiratory rate of 10 breaths per minute. So you want to start on low settings and then adjust them as necessary to get to where you want to be. So maybe use an inspiratory time of 1 second or even less if it's a cat or a small dog, and an expiratory time of 4 seconds. And with the Penlon, you want your inspiratory flow rate to be at its lowest setting, which is 0.25 litres per second. Chest movements on the ventilator should be the same as those that you would expect to see if the patient wasn't on a ventilator. If you increase the inspiratory flow, that will increase the pressure. Watch the patient's chest movements, but don't forget to watch the pressure gauge. As I said earlier, normally inspiratory pressures are about 12 to 15 centimetres of water for a medium or large dog, and maybe 8 to 10 centimetres of water for a small dog or cat. But remember, when you're performing a thoracotomy, the lungs can just pop out of the thoracic cavity because the cavity is open, so it may be necessary to decrease the pressure. So if you've got capnography, that's brilliant. Use that to manipulate your settings. Get your settings to where you want them to be, and generally, during most routine procedures, once you've got your settings where you want them and where you're happy with your capnography, you don't need to change them. But then obviously at the end of surgery or at the end of the period when you need to be off the ventilator, we need to get the patient breathing again on its own. So to induce spontaneous respirations at the end of the procedure, either adjust the settings to hypoventilate, so you need to reduce the respiratory rate, or you might just be that you prefer to just disconnect from the ventilator, put it back on the breathing system. Don't forget to open the APL valve and reattach your scavenge, and then just manually perform IPPV at a slow rate until he's breathing again on their own. So the other ventilator that we're going to look at is a Merlin. This is really top end of the market. Really nice, very versatile ventilator. Computer controlled. You can use either gas from your anaesthetic machine, or you can use room air. So it's suitable for long term use. It can be used in pretty much any mode, fashion, cycling, with any breathing system. It's got a nice LED display, and all of your parameters plus your error messages are clearly displayed here. This ventilator will also calculate and show you what the compliance is. One thing you must remember when you're setting up Merlin for the very first time is you have to get a non-return valve. And that must be fitted into the inspiratory limb to make sure that there's one-way gas flow, because there aren't any one-way valves in this internal pipework. But this is normally supplied with the ventilator. So here's a diagrammatical representation of the front panel of Merlin, and I'd like to thank Keith Simpson from Vetronic for allowing me to use this picture. So you can see here that we've got figures for tidal volume, inspiratory and expiratory rate, maximum airway pressure, and then this is the pressure in the inspiratory port, and this is the pressure in the expiratory port. Now you'll see here that the maximum airway pressure is actually a lot higher than the 20 centimetres of water that I've been talking about. And the reason for this is that when it's used in volume cycling mode, we set this to about 5 or maybe 10 centimetres of water above normal. It's a safety feature and allows a buffer against the above the expected pressure. The patient themselves won't generate that much pressure, and you can see it on this right hand gauge. So here we'll look at how to set it up. So you attach the tubing appropriately turn the machine on at the back. If you switch, we're going to talk really about volume cycling because that is how it operates most effectively and it's the more common mode. So switch the set tidal volume control down and you will see volume mills. That's volume cycling. Set all your parameters. Your tidal volume is usually around 10 mils per kilo, your inspiratory, expiratory time. In volume cycling mode, we're going to set the maximum airway pressure to about 10 centimeters higher. The assist control mode, I'll talk about in a moment, but we're going to leave that off. Set your fresh gas flow on your anaesthetic machine. Now, if you're using Merlin with a non-rebreathing system, your fresh gas flow needs to be slightly higher than the minute volume. With a circle, then you only need very, very low flows, really just sufficiently to meet metabolic requirements. So I'm talking here of 300, 400, 500 mils, very low. And then you start ventilating by just selecting ventilator mode, switch it to run, and the ventilator will kick in. So here's a picture of Merlin actually in use, and you can see we've got here the tidal volume is 290 mils, inspiratory rate is 1 second, expiratory rate is 3 seconds. The maximum airway pressure has been set to 25. This is the little switch. When it goes down, it's volume cycled. When it goes up, it's pressure cycling. So that would be for small patients or when you're using a non-rebreathing system. Here, Merlin set to stop means it doesn't ventilate, set to run means it does. And then you've got your inspiratory port pressure, which you can just see has gone up to about 17.5 centimetres of water, so that's absolutely fine. And over here we've got expiratory port pressure. And then all of these figures are shown here. I don't know whether you can see them, but it does say up here, tidal volume 290 mils. And then it's got minute volume there, and it says 4.35 litres. Remember, the minute volume is the tidal volume multiplied by the respiratory rate. So we've got a tidal volume of 290 here multiplied by the respiratory rate of 15. That will give us 4,350. Over here, we've got AP, which is airway pressure. And it says here 16 over 4. Now, 16, the first figure, is actually the pressure in the inspiratory port. The second figure, if it's not zero, is PEEP. So here we're using positive end expiratory pressure of 4 centimetres of water. Inspiratory-expiratory ratio here is 1 to 3, and it shows us the compliance. Compliance here is 24. Compliance is measured in mils per centimetres of water, and this is a normal value for this patient. Now, the assist control method mode over here, you can either have it off, which is down, or on, assist mode. When this is used, the ventilator augments spontaneous breaths, so it can be used to wean a patient from the ventilator, or it can be used in the intensive care setting to assist breathing. So sometimes we use it for patients that are on the ventilator because of a medical reason, so maybe tetanus patients or patients with brain injury. And that LED setting will also show us the error messages. Now, if you get an error message, all of your other parameters disappear, and you will also get an alarm, and which is audible and visual. So here you can see that the alarm button is lit up and it's also sounding. You need to obviously address this low inspiratory pressure. This shows if the peak inspiratory pressure doesn't meet as much as 4 centimetres of water. So when this happens, you need to check the settings, check your patient, make sure the ventilator is still connected and extubation hasn't occurred. And then you need to reset the alarm by flicking this switch here. When you do that, all of your parameters will show again on the display. Ventilation isn't interrupted, but you do have to reset that alarm to get back to the normal screen. The other message that you might see is maximum pressure exceeded. And here we've got an overpressure situation. So again, check the patient, check the settings, make sure the airway isn't occluded and that chest inflation is not restricted. If the patient is spontaneously breathing, it might be that it's trying to breathe out against an inspiration from the ventilator. So again, you just need to reset your alarm. We need to evaluate the efficiency of ventilation. By far the best way to do this is with capnography. So if you have a capnograph, really you need to be using it. Hypercapnia will indicate hypoventilation, but normally when we mechanically ventilate patients, we will see hypocapnia, so a low end tidal reading, and that's because we are overventilating, so we need to reduce the respiratory rate. The peak inspiratory pressure, watch the number on the ventilator, watch the needle. As a general rule, you don't want it to be over 20 centimetres of water, unless there's a reason that that figure needs to be higher or lower. Pulse oximetry assesses oxygenation, not ventilation. SpO2 really should be more than 95%, because if it's less than that, that might indicate the beginning of desaturation. An SpO2 of less than 92% will indicate hypoxemia, if that's a true and valid reading. You can look at your chest and bag movements. Are they the same? Are they synchronized? Are they normal? And spirometry is assessment of flow volume loops. Again, this is really beyond the scope of this lecture, because we're looking at advanced anesthetic monitoring. But for those of you that do have a multi-parameter monitor that has the facility for spirometry, I've just got a couple of photos to show you of normal and abnormal loop. So when we're looking at flow volume loops, this is the bit that we're looking at. And this here is a normal loop. We've got a nice equal amount each side of the loop. It's a little tall maybe, but that's really what a loop should look like. This, however, is not a normal loop. This is a pug dog that was going for airway surgery. So you can see here this loop is very small. It's very flat. There's no height to it. We've got unequal volumes each side of the line here, very small volume. And then if you look at the other ventilation parameters, we've got a respiratory rate of 50, so very high, a low end tidal CO2 of 28 millimeters of mercury, and really poor capnogram. These are just what we call sinusoidal waves, just up and down. There's no shape, there's no plateau to them. This pug dog needs to go on the ventilator. But just to illustrate how ventilation and oxygenation differ, this dog's SpO2 is 100%. And we don't always rely on the number. The best thing with SpO2 is to look at the shape of the waveform. And this pleth waveform is actually really nice. So oxygenation in this dog is good. Ventilation is very poor. Weaning from the ventilator, you need to get the animal to breathe on its own, so you need to reduce the respiratory rate, you need to allow CO2 to build up, and hopefully that will trigger breathing. Once spontaneous respirations have resumed, then you can switch the ventilator off, connect it to the breathing system. It may be that you prefer to just manually ventilate the patient straight away, take it off the ventilator, so use a suitable system. Remember to open your APL valve again. And normocapnia really should be attained before taking your patient off of the supply of oxygen. A little bit of troubleshooting. Hypocapnia, as I said, really is one of the most common things that we see, and it's because we're ventilating them too much. So decrease the respiratory rate. You can do this by increasing the expiratory time and maybe increasing the inspiratory time. The respiratory rate should match the expected rate for the patient if it wasn't on a ventilator. For example, around 12 to 15 rests per minute for a dog, and higher for a small dog or a cat, so maybe 16 to 25 breaths per minute. Reduce the inspiratory flow on a Penlon or the airway pressure on other models. Make sure your fresh gas flow isn't too high. As I said, with a circle, really about 500 mils per minute, if it's a dog, should be sufficient. You will need higher flows when you're using a T-piece or another non-rebreathing system, but as long as rebreathing doesn't occur, you need capnography to know that, then the fresh gas flow can be reduced. Check for leaks, use a cuffed ET tube or a pharyngeal pack to make sure you've got a good seal, and just check your patient isn't about to arrest. Hypercapnia, then make sure your rest rate is adequate and that you haven't taken hyperventilation to the extreme, so you might need to increase your rest rate. Make sure your fresh gas flow is high enough. You can try slowly, incrementally turning your inspiratory flow rate up if you've got the Penlon, or just putting in a higher inspiratory pressure on other models. If you're using a circle system, make sure your soda lime isn't exhausted, and check that your patient's not too deep, and also check his temperature. Make sure they're not too cold, because that is a reason for hypercapnia. Hypoxemia, check with your surgeon to see if there's a surgical reason. So, for example, if they're filling the thorax with lavage fluid during thoracotomy, then that will probably turn your patient blue and give you scary pulse oximetry readings. Or surgical manipulation, there might be four hands in the chest. If there is no surgical reason, then make sure your fresh gas flow is sufficient. Check your pressure gauge. It might be that increasing the pressure slowly will improve oxygenation. Make sure your inspiratory flow is where it should be. Maybe consider adding a PEEP valve to the system, or adding PEEP if you've got a ventilator that has that facility. And if you have got blood gas analysis, then check your blood gases. Remember, you can't rely on the pulse oximeter to determine oxygenation status of arterial blood. Your SpO2 value and your actual value from blood gas analysis are not the same. So if you have an iStat or an EPOC machine, then use it. But remember, that will only give you the oxygenation status at that particular time of testing. Other things that you can try are suctioning the lumen of the ET tube. So turn your ice flow or siever flow off, disconnect your patient, and then if you've got a small tracheal suction tube, suction the lumen, because it may be full of fluid. Suction around the back of the pharynx. You might want to re-intubate the trachea with a new tube if necessary. And it might just be that you disconnect your patient from the ventilator and perform manual IPPV. Some instances, that is more effective. Okay, to finish off with then, we're just going to look at a case study. This is a case that actually presented about 3 weeks ago at the practice where I work. So it's a male 10-year-old border collie, 24 kilograms, and he came in for upper GI endoscopy because he had chronic vomiting, diarrhea, and a very painful tummy. So he was pre-medicated with methadone and acepromazine. Anesthesia was induced with diazepam and propofol, and he was maintained with sevoflurane. A little way into the procedure, he had increased parameters, heart rate, respiratory rate, blood pressure, which indicated that he was really feeling it and he was painful. So he had a fentanyl bolus, which predictably resulted in apnea. So the easiest thing was to put him on a ventilator. So he was put on a Merlin ventilator in volume cycling mode. Now, I'm just going to give you a few seconds to just think about these questions. If you want to type the answers in the Q&A section, that's fine, or jot them down on a piece of paper, or just have a little think about them. So what tidal volume would be set for this patient? He's a 24-kilogram dog. What respiratory rate do you think is appropriate? What would be the suitable inspiratory and expiratory times to give you that respiratory rate and to maintain normocapnia? And what maximum airway pressure should be set? So this is a Merlin ventilator and we're using it in volume cycling mode. So if you want to type your answers in, that's fine. And in just a second, I will give you the answers that I think would have been appropriate for this dog. Okay, so for this chap, then tidal volume, he weighs 24 kilograms, so using 10 mils per kilo, tidal volume of 240 mils. We want a respiratory rate of about 10 to 15 breaths per minute, with an inspiratory time of 1 to 1.5 seconds, and an expiratory time of 3 to 4 seconds, and hopefully that would maintain normocapnia. In volume cycling mode, we set the maximum airway pressure to 10 centimetres of water higher than the normal peak inspiratory pressure. So a dog of this size probably is going to have a peak inspiratory pressure of somewhere between 12 and 15 centimetres of water. Therefore, the setting of 25 centimetres will ensure that if it does go that high, it will certainly stop. Now, if we were using pressure cycling mode on Merlin, then the maximum airway pressure setting that you use is that which the ventilator will actually reach before ending inspiration. So therefore, you won't use the 10 centimetres higher. Pressure cycling is usually used for small patients or very young patients. So if we happen to be using pressure cycling for this 24 kilogram dog, we'd only set the maximum airway pressure to 15 centimetres of water. So the next few slides are photographs of the anaesthetic monitoring machine, because we're going to focus on evaluating the ventilation using capnography. So this is at the beginning of mechanical ventilation, and you can see that we've got a poor shape to the capnogram. This is not a good shape, and here, these little clefts or dips here, this is a classic bucking the ventilator. The patient is trying to breathe for himself. We've got a high end tidal CO2, which is 53 millimetres of mercury. But we also have, I don't know if you can see, but that says 35. We've also got a high respiratory rate. So what's happening is the capnograph is picking up the inefficient spontaneous respirations, and it's adding them to the respiration rate from the ventilator. The actual end tidal CO2 of 53 is from the ventilator respirations. So to overcome the spontaneous respirations, we need to abolish the drive to breathe by increasing the respiratory rate to depress the CO2 levels. And in this case, the CO2 levels are high and they need to be lowered. Here we've got spontaneous breaths have been abolished, but again, we've got a very poor shape to the capnogram. This isn't good. There's no plateau. There's no nice, even top to it. And we've got quite a long, sloping upstroke. And that indicates that there's a long expiratory time. The end tidal CO2 is low at 12. The respiratory rate's good. The end tidal is 32. Sorry, the respiratory rate is 12, which is good. So what we need to do now is to get that end tidal CO2 back up. We want to keep the respiratory rate around the same, and we want a better shaped capnogram. So the initial settings that we used, inspiration time 1 second, expiration time 4 seconds. So the whole cycle was 5, 60 divided by 5 gives us the 12. So this is where it's nice to manipulate the settings to our advantage. So we can decrease the expiratory time and increase the inspiratory time to improve the shape of the capnogram. So here, our new settings, we've changed to an inspiratory time of 1.5, and we've shortened the expiratory time to 3.5 seconds. So we've got the same cycle period of 5 seconds, still gives us a resp rate of 12. You can't see that, it's just out of shot. But the capnogram now is a much better shape. We've got a bit of a plateau, it is sloping upwards, but we've got no clefts, no dips, and that's a nice shape, that's acceptable. And also our end tidal CO2 has improved to 47 millimetres of mercury. So the next slide is the video clip. It's only a very short video, and you should be able to see it here. I would just to illustrate that we've got nice consistent capnogram. So if you can see here, the capnogram shape doesn't really alter. It's still nice. We've got a nice end tidal of 47. It does rise to 51, but basically we're happy with this type of ventilation. And then weaning this chap off of the ventilator at the end of the endoscopy procedure. You can see small spontaneous breaths at the end of the trace. So here, little one, this is a ventilator breath, this is a ventilator breath. Trying to take him off, so increasing the time. Little tiny breath, that's not going to be efficient ventilation, but at least he is trying to breathe for himself. So for him, we needed to continue artificial ventilation. Now you can do this with the ventilator, or you can disconnect the ventilator and do it manually until spontaneous breaths are sufficient. In other words, until we have normocapnia. And this chap was weaned very easily from the ventilator and breathed for himself well. So in conclusion, controlled mechanical ventilation is always more precise than manual IPPV. You need to familiarise yourself with the ventilator if you haven't used it before, or if you haven't used it for a long time. Make sure you're familiar with all its knobs and controls and ways in which it operates. You can do this using a rebreathing bag without any animal attached. Just attach a bag onto the patient end of the circuit and that will mimic the lungs. Use it on routine ops first. Don't go straight in with the really sick or the high-risk patients, or the open chest surgery for the first few times. Just use it on routine bitch spays or dog castrations or similar. You can use it in conjunction with capnography if at all possible. Capnography really is the best way to make sure that ventilation is adequate. And then when you decide to or need to ventilate, the anaesthetic process can be much smoother as it controls annoying respiratory patterns. And therefore, the patient does better because there are no peaks and troughs in the depth of anaesthesia, and it's less stressful for you monitoring the anaesthetic. So if you are new to mechanical ventilation, just take a deep breath and put your patient on the ventilator. Thank you very much for listening this afternoon. If you have any questions, you can type them in the Q&A section, and I'll be happy to try and answer them for you. Okay, so there's a question here. How would settings be adjusted for patients with possible lung damage, such as airway disease? So with these patients, you need to be very careful that you don't blast their alveoli open. So you need low pressures for these guys. So you don't want the alveoli to rupture, and you don't want to cause pulmonary re-expansion edema. So it might be better to have a higher respiratory rate with a lower inspiratory pressure rather than what we would consider a normal pressure and a slower respiratory rate. For airway disease, remember, you do have to also keep an eye on pulse oximetry. Capnography, remember, assesses ventilation. Oximetry measures oxygenation. And when is the best time to start mechanical ventilation? Is it after induction or when you get into theatre? Well, this is often personal preference. However, it would depend on the number and location of ventilators. I always like to get them on the ventilator as soon as possible, because then you've got a better chance of overriding spontaneous respirations. If you leave it till you're in theatre, the patient may still be trying to breathe for itself at the beginning of surgery. However, if you only have one ventilator and it's not mobile and it's set up and stationed in theatre, you don't really have a choice. You have to just get them on to the ventilator as soon as you get into theatre. Personally, I don't wait. If you're doing a thoracotomy and you need to ventilate as soon as the chest is open, I would just get them on as soon as you hook them up in theatre. You've still got your preparation time, and then your surgeon's got to come over and scrub and glove and gown and what have you. Don't wait till the chest is open I personally would do it as soon as possible. I think that's all. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Denise for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.